Ah, Mr. Pod, we've been expecting you. Welcome, one and all, to Empire Sensational Super Soraway Skyfall Spoiler Special. I'm Chris Hewitt, and I'll be your tuxedo-wearing host. Not actually wearing a tuxedo, I'm wearing a t-shirt with Ingmar Bergman's name on it. For the next hour or so, as a team of carefully selected Empire operatives, double O's or otherwise, delve into the whys and wherefores of Sam Mendes' new Bond film. We'll also be joined by a special guest or two, all part of our ongoing celebrations of Jimmy Bond's 50th birthday. And those operatives are Dan Jolin, head of Schmersh, and our man on the set of Skyfall.
I am the Skyfallologist.
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 Yes.
Ian Freer, chief of Spectre.
Hello, Christopher. I'm putting down my Heineken now to get into this. Now.
I noticed by your Omega watch, it is now 10 to 5.
Oh, yeah, the Audi's waiting outside.
And, of course, Phil Deschamlian, founder and treasurer of Subtitle. How are you, Phil?
Very well, Chris, says the man who's wearing an Ingmar Bergman t-shirt.
True, but I watched the dubbed versions.
Yeah. Actually, he hasn't even seen an Ingmar Bergman film, have you?
Yes, I have.
Which one?
We'll cut that bit out. If you haven't listened to a spoiler special before, be it The Dark Knight Rises or The Avengers or The Amazing Spider-Man, it's really, really very simple. We discuss the film in minute detail. We give away everything. So don't listen to this unless you've seen Skyfall or if you're just really weird and spoilers get you off. Okay, in order to impose a semblance of order on proceedings by using the word order twice in one sentence, I'm going to split this up into sections for us to discuss. So let's start at the very beginning. With the very beginning and the pre-credit sequence, which I thought was a wonderful reintroduction to Bond, because he's been away for 4 years, and it was a nice the very opening shot of Craig walking down the corridor. I really, really liked Ian.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it kicked off into its action sequence, which was a really strong opening, one of the best ones I've seen. Probably not as good as Casino Royale's opener, but it's a really strong action sequence.
When you say Casino Royale's opener, do you mean the parkour sequence?
I do, yeah.
Because that's post-credits.
Oh, you see.
That's the first action sequence in the movie. But the Casino Royale, it was so hell-bent on the tone and atmosphere and reintroducing the idea that he was killing people to get his 00 status. I kind of find it's a little bit cerebral, a little bit dull, that opening, I find, with the bathroom fight.
That's the black and white stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Quantum of Solace has that frightfully dreadful car chase as well. Dan, what did you think about this one?
I thought it was actually, in terms of action, it was the highlight of the film, action-wise.
Yeah.
I actually didn't feel that it kind of peaked as high for the rest of it. Especially when they got on the bikes and went over the roofs. I like that bit, especially. Yeah. And then once they're on the train as well, there was that. We saw it in the trailer,
mm-hmm.
with the little grace note. With the cuff check,
yes,
yeah, very fish,
yeah,
very
fish. That was, I think, Kim said a great thing in his review, which was, it's almost as if everything that happened in Doctor No and Die Another Day has happened now to the Daniel Craig Bond since Quantum of Solace, and so
that means he's lost two women in his life, hasn't he? Two women have died on him by that point.
That's true. But he's got over it now. He's got over it. But it's kind of like, almost like going, "Oh right, here's Bond. He's in his stride, and he can handle these situations, and he's got that cockiness and that confidence, and that little moment kind of really sold that idea."
Yeah, well, there are numerous references to Bond being an older gentleman and having passed. I'm not so sure. I see what Kim's driving at with that if you wanted to, you could say that this is both prologue and coda to the Craig Bonds. But I would like now to see, because the movie, as we know, ends at a very specific place, and it ends at a very Dr. No referencing place, and it kind of reboots the reboot. And I would actually almost like to see now this Craig tackle a Dr. No, or tackle a Blofeld, and maybe actually remake one of the Bonds. Where do we stand?
I think that's where it's going, isn't it?
Yeah,
it would seem to be going that way. Yeah,
if you could, and it would probably be one of the Connerys. Which one would you go for if Craig had a remake of Connery?
I'd want to see what Blofeld would look like in this incarnation.
Because you couldn't go down the Dr. Evil route. You couldn't do that.
No, how do you do that? That's fascinating, isn't it? Let's see what happens with that.
So long hair.
Yeah.
Blonde.
Yeah.
Effete.
No pets.
No, wait a minute.
No pets.
No pets. He lives in an apartment in Walthamstow.
Did you know?
Precisely. I will say one thing I was disappointed about. This has been consistent all through the Craig Bonds so far, and I think I said this in the podcast a few weeks ago, is that I was desperate for this movie to open with the gun barrel sequence, and it doesn't. And I get the narrative reasons for doing that.
Yeah.
But I just feel fairly strongly that
you get
a Bond
it at the
film,
end.
You get it at the end, and
does,
as I said,
that not work for you?
No, it doesn't work for me at all. And I know there's narrative reasons for that.
Yeah.
That at this, at the end of this movie, more than any other Craig movie, he is now the James Bond we know and love.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll start doing it from the next one onwards.
Yeah, they will.
But for me, a Bond movie is like no other movie. It has to start in that way.
It was the thing about Never Say Never Again, was it? It didn't have the barrel and it didn't have the tune. And
Am I right
in thinking Dr. No didn't either?
It kind of does. It doesn't have the tune as such, but it starts with a tune and it goes into something else.
Yeah.
What this all felt like to me was, it's kind of a semi-reboot within a reboot, isn't it? Because we've had Casino Royale, and then we had Quantum Solace, which most people didn't really like, enjoy. Mm. They talked very explicitly at the press conference launching this film about moving away from the Quantum plotline. And so it is kind of a narrative reboot, but it also feels like a kind of, again, they've started the franchise over in a sense. And what Sam Mendes has done, it feels to me like one of those songs where it kind of, it strips everything away and then adds layers of instrumentation to it.
Mm.
And as the film goes from quite a sort of solid start, it kind of adds the bits of Bondiness. You know, you get the DB5 and you get the old Bond score. The stuff kicks in quite late. You don't see the villain for the first, I think I looked at my watch, it was about an hour and 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So for me, it didn't feel weird to have the gun barrel at the end, in a way, because I feel like, especially when you got to that last, I know we're going to come onto it, but just to touch on that last Q transition and when he walks in, that felt the most like the old Connery, Roger Moore Bond films, going to M's office, seeing Moneypenny, all of that stuff.
Mm.
And then it really felt like, yes, now we're ready to go for the next one.
No, I get that.
Get over it, Chris.
No, as I said, I understand the narrative reasons for doing it. But I sit in the cinema and I was so hyped, and I said to some people beforehand, if it starts with the gun barrel sequence and the James Bond theme, I will lose my shit. And
well, that's why they didn't do it.
You were slightly more graphic than that, if I recall correctly.
I had a diagram, if I remember rightly. But it didn't, and it just started like another film, and Quantum of Solace started like another film, and Casino Royale started like another film. And I know Casino Royale had that quite clever twist on the gun barrel sequence, and that was okay, but I don't think it should be something that we're rewarded with at the end of 2 hours or Quantum Solace, however long it felt. It should be something straight up front saying, I'm James Bond, I'm a James Bond film, and no other action franchise starts like this.
But you do that with your title sequence, don't you? When you get to the title sequence, and this one kind of weaves in narrative elements to it much strongly than some of the other ones has done, hasn't it? It tells you about
dragons and stuff.
I mean,
absolutely. I feel like the Bond, there are many things that go into the beginning of a Bond film that you don't get in other films. You know, that extended action sequence, for one thing. And then this incredible Daniel Kleinman credit scene. I don't know how you guys felt about it compared to Casino Royale, which is another really, really good one that he did recently.
I think
Quantum Solace less so.
I think Quantum Solace is actually a pretty decent one, but I honestly don't remember it
in Quantum of Solace.
Well, I saw it again recently because after I saw Casino Royale and I was so pumped, having rediscovered my love of Bond, I put on Quantum of Solace immediately and lasted 10 minutes. I lasted through the pre-credits bit and then the credits and then the opening bit with Mr. White, and I was just like, you know what, this is, I could be watching a much more interesting Mr. White and put on a Breaking Bad episode. But it's pretty good. It's, you know, lots of jazzy graphics and whatnot. I mean, you look at some of the Moore ones are terrible.
Yeah.
Apart from it's just basically naked ladies dancing around. Did I just say that out loud?
Just naked ladies. They were the best ones, weren't they?
I don't know.
I suppose speaking as a child, that was the closest I got to pornography. Was with the Bond opening credits.
Well, that's the thing. Now with an HD TV, you can actually, you know, if you were so inclined, You can see everything.
Really?
It's a little Alan Partridge
where you can nearly see something. Is that what he goes on about?
Yeah, all but not quite.
But on a 50-inch screen, you kind of can. I think Partridge's eyes would
It's not the only thing that's 50-inch.
Hey! What?
What's the other... And the Adele song In Situ worked well, I thought.
It's a proper song.
Lyrically, it's nonsense. I mean, I know they're all up, but lyrically, if you try and follow the thread of it,
Don't worry about it. It's a proper number. It's not like the last two where it's like, you know, it all starts all with the cool stuff's going on the screen and then what's this dirge? Do you know what I mean? At least with this one.
It's got a lovely little piano intro, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The piano intro, the belting female vocal, the strings, the orchestra. It's what you want from a Bond song. Not none of this. What was the last one? Who were those people?
Jack Keys, who were those horrible people
spoiling my Bond song?
Horrible people.
There'd be people here that would fight for Chris Cornell's song.
I would get my hands dirty for Chris Cornell. No rock in Bond. No, Live and Let Die.
That's the exception that proves a rule.
You're an idiot.
How does an exception prove a rule?
It's a very important philosophical question that we can't go into now.
Okay. This hasn't gone quite the way I was expecting, I'll be honest. But
then do we catch him like he's on the beach, isn't he? Where he's on the beach. He's had his judicious use of Heineken in that moment, doesn't he?
I love that, actually. Yeah. I love that. I love the way that, you know, there's this controversy. Oh, Heineken. How can they have Bond drinking Heineken when he's at an absolute low, when he's screwed up and he doesn't get any worse, he resorts to Heineken. So it's almost like a genius thing
with the scorpion.
Yeah,
that was great. Really proper Bondian touch, that, isn't it?
Yeah, no, really, really lovely.
Really smart.
But it's either scorpion or Heineken.
I did like the reintroduction of exotic creatures, actually, into the bottle. I'm not just talking about Berenice Marlowe. The scorpion and the Komodo dragon. When I saw the Komodo dragon, when they first appeared, I was just like, if somebody doesn't fall down into that pit by the end of this sequence, I'm walking out.
So I must have looked at my watch or something at that point, because I didn't know there were Komodo dragons in that sequence, despite having had Thomas Newman's Skyfall score on my iPhone for like a couple of days beforehand, and one of the tracks is the Komodo dragon. I hadn't realised there was an actual Komodo dragon until he fell in the pit. And then it felt a bit
I was very happy because I got to tick off my Live and Let Die checklist, thing that I carry with me at all times, and just to see that, to see him jump above on the heads of the Komodo dragons was terrific.
Yeah. It's like the dragon they didn't have in Doctor No, isn't it?
Yes.
It was by the dragon.
The dragon.
The dragon turns out to be like a vehicle. A flamethrowing vehicle that moves really, really slowly across
the
beach.
And of course, Komodo dragons are absolute bastards.
They are absolutely not bastards.
Yeah. They are. You ask Sharon Stone's ex-husband.
Yeah.
There you go. Well,
Craig's good.
Why?
Craig's good in that bit of stretch, I think.
Yeah, but he didn't kill him. And they're not renowned for attacking humans unprovoked, are they?
Well, no, because they tend to be kept in zoos where people can't, or exotic gambling dens where people can't leap on them. But yeah, you're right, Craig sells all that stuff. I mean, I've read some people and I've seen some people say he seems uncomfortable with the wisecracking, more Roger Moore-y aspects of Bond.
There's a brilliant Roger Moore moment in this film, isn't there?
Yeah.
When he gets on the tube and there's a couple on the platform.
Yes.
That's amazing, isn't it?
What was the line again? What was the line?
He must be keen to get home.
Yeah.
But also, I thought there was a pigeon doing a double take in that shot as well.
That's after the health and safety gag as well.
Great, was that? Yeah.
And no, he sort of kind of... It's a bit more sort of it's a few levels deeper than it is with Sir Roger with his ones with the quips. Maybe it doesn't come quite as easily, but I think he still sells it well.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, that's how they could have got the Heineken into it as well if they hadn't done this route. The guy doing the crazy stunt, tourist standing there drinking Heineken, looks at the bottle.
Oh yeah,
spills it.
Because it's one thing the film does not shy away from, and it did it in a much classier way, I thought, than Die Another Day with the 40th anniversary, with all those little nods to Bond's past.
Yeah,
and chief, obviously, amongst those is the introduction of the DB5, the Aston Martin, Aston Martin.
Yeah, but gets gags after it afterwards when they're sitting in the car and it's uncomfortable.
Yes,
I'm sure Aston Martin loved that bit.
Is one of the best gags when he contemplates ejecting M for just a split second.
And I thought he was going to use the ejector seat at some point.
Yeah, me too. I thought one of Silver's goons was going to get it.
Yeah,
he was going to eject
someone up into the helicopter or something. You know, just do something.
I really like that about the way that they did that, because they did. It could have just been a nod, a cursory thing, but they actually, you know, got the machine guns out. It became a really important plot point, and I thought that was great. I was like, does he now have the machine guns or the oil slick or you know, any of that stuff? And they did, and that was great.
I also love the way that when they blew up the Aston Martin, that was it for him. He sits look on his face, right, that's it, and then he sort of goes ape.
You can kill people I've got a passing emotional attachment to. You may threaten my boss and you may threaten my country, but do not mess with my car. That is it. It's the same thing with Batman, I guess, in the Dark Knight. But one of the things about the Aston Martin I loved as well was just again how much of a classy touch it was, you know. And unlike Die Another Day, where Pierce Brosnan is faffing around in Q's lab, and you see all these different, you know, Rosa Klebb's shoe and different things like that. It's just clumsy nods, I thought. But this one had an element of panache about it. Were there any others that I
there's kind of, there's been chase across the rooftops in Istanbul before in From Russia With Love.
The little exchange with Q, where he says, makes the personal statement line and gives him the new Walter PPK, well, that was a direct reference to Dr. No. There's almost an identical scene where the quartermaster, who wasn't Desmond Llewellyn, gave Bond the new gun. So that was a little riff.
Yeah, and there's things of Bond in front of gravestones, which he did in For Your Eyes Only.
That's right, yeah.
He did that, and he's in front of his family's gravestone this time. So they're never heavy-handed, though. She's quite nice, isn't it? It's nice little nods.
What does Q say in that sequence when he gives him, and then he gives him that little tracking device, and he says, "We don't give out exploding pens anymore."
Exploding fountain pens anymore. Yes,
it's very good.
Somehow, I imagine for the next one, they may well find themselves back in the exploding pen business.
Oh. Can I have to see what everyone thinks about it. So I've got a theory. Uh-huh. It's a crazy theory, I think, but I don't know. Is it?
You're mad.
Yes.
Is that it?
No. When we get to, could we kind of skip into the end a bit? I don't know. You had a structure, Chris.
Screw the structure.
I'm going to tread on your structure.
Screw it.
That's it. That's the structure. It's gone.
You tread on my dreams, Dan, every day.
That's true. I try to. But anyway, we get up to Skyfall Lodge, and then there's the big reveal. There's the guy, the old guy up there, right? Albert Finney.
Yeah. As Nick said, groundskeeper Willie.
Yes. I think that part was written for Sean Connery.
Well, that's not. Ooh. Yeah, that's not the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, so I keep going on about it. But I want to get this out there.
Well, you were a Skyfallologist.
I am the Skyfallologist. My theory is that they at least considered that part. I could just imagine him going, you know, "You jumped up, little shit," you know, and that being Connery saying that.
It is the sweariest Bond, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
First ever F-bomb in a Bond.
Really?
Yeah, said by Judy Dench.
Yeah. What do you guys, did you think it's feasible that they, you know, even that "Welcome to Scotland" line, you can imagine Connery saying that. Do you think it's feasible step along? I mean, obviously, we at some point, I will ask someone involved in this film whether or not that was ever a thought, but I haven't had the chance yet, so what do we think?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it's possible, but I just thought Albert Finney gave it some real warmth, he gave it a sense of, as Kim says in his review, of gravitas. I think he gives it a little role and he makes something of it.
I really, really liked the final shootout for many reasons, one of which was the fact that for the first time in Bond history, it's bad guys storming Bond's stronghold, which we've never really seen before. Also, it kind of took it from me into Jack Reacher territory, because, you know, Reacher does that quite a lot.
Straw Dogs as well.
He fights off Straw Dogs, yes. Yep. Yeah, that was a problem. Yep. Who knows?
And Outlaw Josie Wales, I thought, it also had echoes of.
We also got to see M wielding a gun, which was interesting. Albert Finney blowing people away with a shotgun, which is always fun. Yeah. But there was one point where the house was being attacked with machine gun fire, and Judi Dench and Albert Finney basically just walk away from the bullets, not in a very cool action movie way, but just because they can't walk any faster. there's a moment where you think, basically, how difficult is it to kill these people? They're old, they're in their 70s, for the love of God, Silva, sort it out. But I really, really liked that last sequence, and I thought he was fantastic.
I mean, one of the things about through the whole film is that the stakes are smaller this time.
Yes.
Isn't it? It's usually about saving the world. Here it's about saving Dame Judi Dench.
Wait, it starts off as much bigger than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that's just a MacGuffin, though.
I know,
it?
And they dispense with the MacGuffin fairly perfunctorily.
Yeah.
If there's a complaint with the plot, they just... That's no longer an issue.
I think
if that is his plan to kill M,
just kill
it's her. a big
he takes the
around the house's plan to kill Ben, isn't it?
He takes the circle line when he, or the district line when he could have taken the
I call it the Joker strategy.
It is. I mean, this movie has been compared, I can't remember what the Kim does it in his review, but if Casino Royale was Bond Begins, then this is The Dark Knight, with Silva being the Joker. And
actually, there's lots of elements of The Dark Knight Rises as well.
Yeah, there are.
Because I'd say save his fantastic opening scene where he does the Omar Sharif walk from the back of the room to the front of the room.
Yeah.
Talking about, what was he talking about? The two mice in the vat of cream.
rats and pineapples. Rats, pineapples and oil canisters or something. Yeah.
That's a terrific scene and he's great. The rest of it, I don't think, he was a decent villain, but I don't think he was, that's his shining moment, isn't it?
Well, that's interesting because I thought the film jumped up a notch when he came in. Largely because he's been built up quite a lot. And maybe you're right. Maybe the actual revelation of Silva doesn't quite match the build-up. I mean, Bernice Marlowe's Severine is basically quivering with fear every time she mentions him. Do you know fear? Yes. And Bond goes,
I don't. You'd be fearful if you were going to get shot with whiskey on your head by antique pistols.
True. But at this point, she's no idea that's going to happen. And he just walks into the room and you kind of get the feeling he's taking a piss slightly. But it's a really bold, interesting noise.
Yeah.
Presumably when he goes to bed, he takes his sort of mouth out. Maybe that's the fear element. I mean, there is that double reveal. The first one, and then they capture him. It's all part of the plan again. Where M lives? She's got a house. Go around there, kill her. Don't worry about any of this stuff. Oh, we've captured him. Bond can get into her house at will, seemingly.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, that's by the by. But then they capture him. They put him in the Hannibal Lecter case, and he does that thing and the amazing, and his face sort of implodes, and it's quite. That for me is he's the villain beneath the villain kind of thing. So that's where the evil menace came.
Yes. I think there's been a lot of talk about whether Silva is the first openly gay Bond villain.
I don't think he is. He's just messing with Bond. Yeah. He's just playing up to, you know, Bond has a reputation and he's just messing with that reputation, trying to wrong foot him.
Yeah.
That hence the whole line where Bond goes, why do you think it's the first time? You know, he's unflappable in that situation.
Or maybe he's done it before.
Well, you know, since the first one, Quantum of Solace, you know, didn't get together with the Bond girl. In this one, you know, there's a quick shower scene.
There's a quick shower scene with Severine. I mean,
he sleeps with Moneypenny as well, right?
Does he? I don't know if he does.
We don't see that. Setting her up as Moneypenny, you can't have him shag her in this film.
I don't think he does.
Yeah, I don't think he does.
Of course he does.
No,
I thought the treatment of Severine was a complete shock to me. Who guessed that?
Yeah.
Who saw that coming?
Yeah. It's so rare in a Bond film for surprises to actually be surprises.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talk before this movie came out when people were first cast, whenever Naomi Harris was first cast. It was like, she's Moneypenny. And when Ralph Fiennes was cast, oh, he's a new M. And you know, all these leaks came out and Eon were going,
they were just very good guesses.
I suspect that someone had been leaking. There's a mole inside MI6. And Eon were going, no, don't listen to that. That's not true. But of course, it is true.
Naomi Harris actually said to me, no, I'm not Moneypenny. It's not Moneypenny.
Right. The same way Michael Bay once said to me, Megatron's not in Transformers 2.
I also thought it was a bit of a ham
fist. Let it go, Chris.
It was a ham fisted reveal when they decided to reveal when she talks about she is Moneypenny. That exchange is a little bit,
but again,
it's such a nice idea though. It's what you want, and it's such a nice idea that you forgive it, but it's a bit ham fisted, isn't it?
And Q as well. I was amazed when they announced that Ben Whishaw was going to play Q. I was like, we knew that 6 months ago. But obviously we didn't, because they hadn't
officially announced it,
but we knew somehow.
Yeah, his agent basically told the BBC, and Aeon didn't want to officially announce it by that time.
But none of that detracted from the film, did it?
Well, really? No, I mean, you know, certainly not with Q, because you're just introducing him as Q. There's no kind of, whereas with Eve, you know, she's introduced as Eve, but I liked the way it was almost like the Moneypenny origin story.
Okay, Moneypenny begins.
Why is she, you know, you've always got the sense that they had a relationship, in the films at least, you always got the sense that they had a relationship that was based on something that you were never told, and what was the source of that frisson between them, and why, you know, why is she seems so smart, and you have this little sort of one-up man and woman-ship between them, and she always, you know, in a lot of situations gets the better of Bond, and where has that come from? And she seems to have a kind of a certain poise to her that would come from someone who was once a field agent. But I also really like the fact that they put in the fact that she shot him.
That's a bit of backstory, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
She didn't shoot him up. Perhaps you guys can tell me this. Where did she shoot him exactly? Because he had the wound from Ulrich Pace. He gets shot in that sequence where you see, and he's in the cabin at the very beginning, and he gets shot with the handily irradiated bullets that they can trace very easily on Google or something. Which I quite liked as well, because it's one of the first times we ever see Bond really getting shot and actually feeling the influences. But where does she shoot him? because he falls about 300 feet into the water and doesn't die, and he doesn't seem to have any bullet holes or anything. Was it just tis but a scratch? It's a flesh wound. Simple as that.
No, I guess I don't know.
In the head, in the head, back and to the left.
He gets better during the credit sequence. He gets just floating in the water. He gets better, and and then he's on the beach drinking Heineken.
He dives into Heineken,
and there's Jason Bourne walking just down the other beach, not drinking Heineken.
I know Helen's not here. Helen, if Helen were here, she always feels a Bond is slightly sexist, and I guess we have to do a nod to that with the treatment of Severin. And also the idea that Eve at the end, she's not happy. She's no use out in the field. She just shoots people in the field.
Yeah, she can't shoot straight.
No, get her behind a desk. That's the way to treat a woman.
The Severin thing was very, it very made me really reminded me of, you know, the sort of Connery Thunderball kind of treatment of the women from the dark, you know, on the dark side of things. You know, there's the bit where he kind of clocks her as having been a sex slave as a child. You know, since the age of 12, she's been forced to have sex with people, and then Silver's like keeping her as a sex pet. And then what does he do?
Yeah.
Does her in the shower straight off, and then, you know, and then it calls her a waste of good scotch when she's killed.
Yeah,
it's a bit harsh.
It's a little harsh,
but at the same time, you know, that's the way Connery played it, and people seem to relish that. Absolutely. In a weird way.
And of course, that's a masking device. He did. There was a connection. He does feel something. It's not just a waste of good scotch. You know, you broke the glass as well.
True.
So what do we feel about some of the other new characters? We talked a bit about Eve. We talked about Q a little bit. Severin, obviously, big surprise. Yeah. I thought it was for a really, really nice moment, actually.
Yeah.
As dark as it is.
Yeah, it was. I also thought Ralph Fiennes gave it something. In terms of Mallory, kind of this kind of ambiguous character who you're not sure which way he's going for an hour or so, and he turned out to be good in the end, and that, you know.
Yeah. With that throwaway reference to his time in Northern Ireland, so when he picks up a gun later on, he's like, well, of course he's been in Northern Ireland. Yeah, everyone in Northern Ireland can handle a gun.
That's true, isn't it?
Racists, unbelievable.
Yeah, as Kim pointed out to me, it does continue a tradition of people from the Avengers joining James Bond casts.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so you've got Diana Rigg and Patrick McNee was in.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about Avengers Assemble for a second there. I was like clocking in my head. I was thinking Chris Hemsworth. No. What the hell is he talking about?
Honor Blackman, Diana Rigg, and John Patrick McNee.
I feel you now.
Yeah.
So now we need Uma Thurman. Oh, and yes. of course, it went the other way, didn't it? With Sean Connery in the Avengers movie.
Yeah. It's just two-way street, that, isn't it?
Yeah. What about the final reveals? We talked a bit about Moneypenny at the end. And where can that role go, really? Because Naomi Harris is such a good actress. I don't want to see her just being reduced to that Lois Maxwell role.
That kind
role
of Samantha Bond of...
Yeah.
Yeah, being a bit more feisty than Lois Maxwell, but not that much more feisty than Lois Maxwell.
And not involved in the plot in any way, shape, or form.
No.
I'd like to see... So we're
and with Ben Whishaw as well. You'd hope that they find things for him to do. And
Even if it was largely just, you know, plug it into things at the end. But yeah, would you like to see Naomi Harris give him more to do, and you'd like to see Moneypenny getting out in the field again, or would she just start shooting the pond?
No.
You want to see her behind the desk?
Yeah. No. But I mean, the thing is, you've established her story in a way. Now it's kind of just, it's like little echoes going on through future Bond films, you would imagine, wouldn't you? It seems kind of wrong in a story-wise. It seems wrong to have a go, then have an excuse to get back out in the field when she's made this big decision to not be in the field anymore.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think story-wise, character-wise, the way they've set it up, it would seem a little odd.
I agree. But
I mean, you know, Q throughout the Bond series has been seen not just inside Q branch. He's been outside. He's met Bond in the field and helped him with things, you know, out there. So, you know, that kind of makes sense story-wise to me.
Do you think Basildon Bond will ever make a return? Russ Abbott's Basildon Bond with, what was his secretary's name? Funny Fanny?
Who is the new Russ Abbott?
What's Russ Abbott doing?
I don't know.
Harry Hill, I guess, is the new Russ Abbott, isn't he? He's never done a Bond parody. He should do.
Yeah, he looks good in the suit.
Funny Fanny, that's a good name.
You're actually writing that down, Chris?
I am writing down Basildon Bond. I'm not writing down Funny Fanny. I have limits. So we liked the idea of Ralph Fiennes being the new M. Then we like him moving on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I thought he was arguably, and I thought he was really added something to a role that could have offered not very much, and mentioned it before, but that final moment where he takes the desk and asks Bond if he's ready for duty. Mm-hmm. I really like that. And they seem to have a little kind of rapport already, the two of them, yeah, together. Yeah. I mean, I think M was such a great bit of casting, Judi Dench. And I'll definitely miss her.
Yeah, because yeah, three cheers for Judi Dench. Yeah.
She was great. I mean, yeah, absolutely. As a swan song, it was phenomenal. When Bond returns, and instead of like, oh, thank God you're alive, she didn't have any idea he was alive. Her first line is, where have you been? You big bastard. And how did you get in my house? And that's great. And that she's just, you know, prickly, yeah, and cool. And they had this kind of, and it develops much more in this film than the previous ones. But they have, yeah, this, he has this real affection for her. Yeah. And I think Daniel Craig plays that very, very well as well.
This is the most she's had to do in a Bond film since probably The World Is Not Enough. Fair to say, when she was, yeah, captured and, yeah, had to free herself using MacGyver-like skills, which is probably what M stands for. But
it stands for Mallory.
Now it does.
No. Yeah. But do you know what her name was? Her name actually is Barbara Maudsley. Barbara, so M stands Maudsley. For Maudsley.
How did you know that, Skyfallologist?
Research, Chris.
On the internet.
Yes.
Did Q help you out?
Yes. Okay. I can't remember. Actually, it came up. I think it came up that was possibly what she was credited as in GoldenEye, which was of course her first appearance.
I think she's always been credited as M, but okay,
I'm pretty sure that's her name. But of course, hey, if I'm wrong, you know, write in.
Yes.
Let us know.
Oh, they will. They will.
We've been talking about other stuff for a little while now. Can we go back to Heineken? Because I'm curious.
Do you want some Heineken?
Are you just watching the clock?
I have
some Heineken.
First.
Oh, go on.
Who spotted more than three Heineken placements in this film?
I wasn't looking, I'll be honest.
I saw two. I'd like to say I don't want to dwell on this, but I clearly do. And the first one at the beginning we talked about, there's, yeah, one on the plane, or he goes to the bar rather, and there's a big fridge full of them behind him.
I didn't see those.
And the one that really got me, where it got a bit silly, is when Q is plotting that route to send Silver up to Scotland, yes, on the map, and the bloke next to him in the office in working hours,
yeah, no, they were outside of working hours by then.
Well, they're in the,
it's
office,
it's like the Empire it's office, we're on press, everyone's a bit tired, oh, it's all gone wrong, someone's kidnapped Mark and they're going up to Scotland with him. Let's get some beers out
Really?
Yeah, that's always it. Having a lager. I just think.
What would have been weird?
What's the world coming to?
If Q had plotted Bond's route to Skyfall on the map and it had gone past all the Heineken breweries in Scotland, and then you just go here, Bond, and have a few bevvies, and then go on to Skyfall. It's my worst Ben Whishaw. But
was that supposed to be Ben Whishaw?
No, it's meant to be Boffin.
Or if you've been using Apple Map.
As the clock is running down, I want to talk about my man of the match, who I think is Roger Deakins,
mm-hmm,
who, yeah, absolutely. Who's shooting on digital these days, and it just looked like film. It looked gorgeous.
Yeah.
Didn't it?
Best looking Bond film. Beautiful. By a mile.
Yeah.
I would say.
What was your favourite shot?
Shanghai was amazing.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of a shot of him running along in Scotland at the end in dark, and he's lighting up the sky in orange, and it just looks beautiful. Mm. Absolutely beautiful.
Like Jarhead, some of those sequences.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. I thought the bit in Shanghai was just breathtaking. You don't come out of a Bond film usually talking about the visuals.
Yeah, yeah. You usually do in the 60s. That's the genius of it. It's a bit like going to watch You Only Live Twice back in the day. It's having that sense that it can still amaze you, and that foreign places can look amazing and exotic, and you can absolutely...
All shot in Pinewood. All those scenes. Shot in Pinewood. Yeah. All on set.
It's remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? Yeah. All the stuff with Ulrich Pace and the fight and the lifts,
yep,
and all,
yep,
of it.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Dan, you've ruined it.
There might have been, to be fair, there was obviously second unit stuff going on there. Yeah. But all the key scenes, because the arrival at the casino. Yeah.
I love that he turns up on a tourist boat on his own, didn't he? That kind of boat he
turns up on. That was symbolic. That was all symbolic. Yeah. It's like the River Styx and the Charon was bringing him back from the dead, you know, and all that.
It's good stuff. The Shanghai skyscraper fight with the mirrors and the reflections. And mirrors seem to be a recurring motif.
Man with the Golden Gun.
Very Man with the Golden Gun, I was going to say. Yeah. Yeah, okay, well.
Mixed with Blade Runner. I like the giant jellyfish, more of that. It's exotic creatures. Again, there you go. Giant jellyfish.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the villain in the next film.
I like the fact one of the very first shots they released from the film was Craig standing on the building.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the end of the film.
Yes, that was our opener, the first feature.
Yeah. It's always nice to have to see in the film.
That's the Department of Energy, isn't it, in Whitehall?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. I've got a friend who works in that building. He works in that building, and he wanted the picture to put up on the office wall.
Oh, really?
Because it was their roof.
Because that stuff that was the stuff they shot on the day that they made the big press conference announcement to the world that it was going to be called Skyfall, one of the worst kept secrets in the movie industry, and then they went off and merrily shot around. I know we've run off a lot of time. I just want to go back to a couple of very, very quick things. The idea that Bond in this movie is broken, at least for the first half or so. He's broken from his fall, he's broken from the treatment he's had, the bullet in the shoulder, the bullet wherever else,
like the Dark Knight Rises.
Moneypenny hits him. He's dishevelled, he's unshaven, drinking. Do you like that?
It never paid off in the second half, it didn't seem to me. He's a wonky shot. He gets the bad scores on all his tests. And then in the final scene, he's shooting outside, he's shooting perfect target practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's never a moment within the fight where it all comes together for him and you have this kind of dramatic moment where he's pulled himself together and it's all brilliant. That never happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I thought, and there's a lot of talk about how old he is. And if he signed on for how many more films? Three or four more films?
Two more films
after this.
By the time he finishes, he'll be as old as Roger Moore was when he started.
Yeah, he's not that old. I mean, he's
43.
Yeah. He's 43, yeah.
Moore was 46 when he started.
So two more. If they get up to a regular production schedule on this, there should be another one in 2014, assuming a quick oil die.
Yeah, he'll be fine.
I agree with that. I mean, it set up something that didn't finish.
You forgot about that.
Suddenly, I'm magically good again.
At least they stuck with it for longer than they did in Die Another Day. Where he turns up, he's got a beard, have a shave, he's back to normal.
Yeah. Craig is better with a beard than Brosnan's better with a beard.
Definitely. But actually, I keep joking about it. It's like with the Dark Knight Rises setting up that Bruce Wayne is, out of shape. And then he just has that kind of little leather strap thing that he puts around his leg. And then it's like, right, Batman again, off we go.
Yeah, he has, Dark Knight Rises, he has a bit of his back literally hanging out of his skin. And then Tom Conti just punches it. Maybe there's a deleted scene in Skyfall where Tom Conti punches Daniel Craig.
Yes, we call it the Conti treatment.
The Conti treatment.
Conti, yes.
The Conti treatment. Let's just make sure. And I want to talk again about Judi Dench as M, because it's been pointed out before that there really isn't a Bond girl in this movie. Not in the traditional sense. And she's the Bond.
Yeah, I think it does miss an Ava Green. I really do. I thought that was kind of its biggest problem in a way.
I think she sets a new benchmark for Bond girls.
How did that tumbleweed get in here? Amazing.
What do you think, Phil? Did you miss it? Did you miss a traditional Bond girl?
I love a traditional Bond girl, Ian.
I have to say, Berenice Marlowe looked amazing, didn't she? Yoni Smarlow.
Yeah, she was
amazing
spectacular.
Looking. Absolutely.
She was spectacular.
Drop dead gorgeous.
And she did.
I don't know what you mean, but I just think this ripped along, and the next one can maybe develop that more. Casino Royale still lingers, the whole Evergreen spectre. And whoever, I think it was Dan, was saying earlier that he had those psychic wounds in his performance, I thought, and in the early parts. He felt this was the guy that went through all of that. And maybe he wasn't ready to commit. Right. But maybe in the next film he'll go online. He's got Q.
Exactly.
Guardian Soulmates.
Exactly.
Match.com. Match.com. Who's going to write his My Single Friend profile?
No one's left.
Nobody's left.
Other dating sites are available.
Yes, we Empire doesn't endorse or promote any of the following sites. But do drink Heineken.
Yes, while wearing an Omega watch.
Is
he still wearing an Omega watch? Or does he?
Whilst driving an Audi. No!
No, driving Aston Martins, he says. What was the other car he drove? Was it?
The VW Beetles.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What did he drive there?
He smashed them up, doesn't he, on the train.
They had to get a mention, though. They were written into the script.
That's a strange one for me. It's like, yes, we will pay you XX to have our product featured in your film, and you're going to trash it. That's a strange one.
They love it, don't they?
Yeah.
And it was Follow That Audi, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Absolutely that.
Yeah. Actually, that was quite interesting, that whole sequence, to have Bond with the earpiece and it all being coordinated from the office. Have we seen that before with a Bond movie? It struck me as a new thing.
Well, at the very beginning.
The very beginning, they're all hipped up and they're all talking.
There are elements in, obviously, Casino Royale when he's he's got the poison in his body.
Yes.
They're talking to him, but again, that sets up M as very, very integral to the plot in this movie, and I really like the relationship between the two of them.
I thought it set a new benchmark for the relationship that M must have with her.
That's brilliant, Dan. That's one thing about it: did Judi Dench M have to die? Could she not just have retired, gone off gracefully? Could he
but
not
that was Mallory's plan all along.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
But you are kind of wasting dramatic meat, aren't you? If he just retires.
But doesn't it make Bond seem a little bit feeble? Because the whole idea about going up to Skyfall, the end of the movie, his whole plan to go off the grid is to go up there so he can protect M. And ultimately, he fails at the one thing he sets out to do.
Right.
So doesn't that make
him... He's going to be taken to a restaurant and fired,
essentially. Well, both he and Mallory seem to have absolutely no repercussions from this whatsoever.
They're blood on their hands. Yeah. They're getting promoted.
Mallory gets promoted. He gets a bulldog, giant dog, and...
What's happened to the file with all the secret agents?
Moneypenny.
No one cares
about
that.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. And Moneypenny as well. She shot another agent and, you know...
Yes, they fell upwards in this organisation.
They Peter Principle their way to the middle. That's
and they're drinking at work.
And they're drinking at work. It's disgraceful. How are none of us...
Not good.
How are we not all just dead if this is like... This is a realistic documentary about the British Secret Service, I'm presuming.
I think it's pretty accurate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Based on no evidence whatsoever of the workings of the British Secret Service. although, of course, we know Phil, you know, is actually secretly...
Yes.
Why does everyone always say that?
One last thing, very, very last thing, is about Silver's plan. We've alluded to it beforehand.
Oh, yeah.
About the idea that this is a Joker-esque grand master plan that is one of those grand master plans in movies that doesn't actually have to make any sense. Because the whole, I want to be caught idea, and then we never see him escaping, and the idea that this plan is so meticulous, has been set in place for years, so he knows every single move that MI6 are going to do. Do we buy it? Do we care about that sort of thing?
You get swept along. I mean, it's like that. You know, if you go back to the Dark Knight, it's does he have a plan? Does he not have a plan? Is it a plan? Is he improvising? What's going on? And you know, but you worry about that on the second or third viewing. Really, I just got swept up in this film and enjoyed it along the way. My only kind of disappointment with Silver's plan was I was absolutely convinced because of the title of the film. That it was all connected to, like the island that he's on, where she says, it's amazing what you can do with one computer, and he makes everyone think there was a chemical leak, and they abandon the island. And I thought that was going to be writ large, or larger, on the world, that he was going to unleash some kind of mass worldwide chaos, or at least that was his plan. And he never was. And all this business was just to get M. So I thought that was a bit of a disappointment. I would have liked to have seen something like that. But hey, that's probably just me... imposing my own expectations.
I feel if you pick the threads of this too much, it does unravel a little bit because of what we've talked about previously in this, that it just, you know, it doesn't really make a great deal of sense that he's got this incredibly convoluted stratagem involving blowing bits of the underground up and piling tube trains through on the off chance that, I mean, it just doesn't. But Bond films often don't, you know. A lot of those old Spectre villains, they wanted Russia and America to nuke each other into the next sort of ice age, stone age. So, you know, you can't look at it too closely, I don't think. You just got to go with it.
No Bond villain plot has ever made sense, so it follows along the grand tradition.
Except for your eyes only, which is the best.
The dullest, I think, is probably what we're driving at there. But otherwise, I think we all love the film and would love to see this carry on in the same vein.
And also, let's not forget that, sorry to interrupt, Quantum of Solace and Scott and Casino Royale, we don't really know what the plan is. We never really sort of figured it out, did we? Just certainly there is a shady organisation doing stuff.
That would involve really watching Quantum of Solace, and I'm not prepared to do that. Not at this juncture, anyway. And that is it for our Skyfall spoiler podcast special. If you have any other questions relating to the movie, please send them in. We'll do our best to answer them on a future podcast. Until then, it is time to say goodbye to Dan, who's got a run.
I have, yes, but thank you, Chris. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks. You've set a benchmark for this podcast. Ian?
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Ian. And Phil?
Dench, isn't dench that slang for like good? Is that right?
Yes.
Well dench.
Which is ironic.
This podcast was well dench.
All right. Happy Heineken, everyone, and I'm off to have a go on Little Nelly. See you next time.